My name is Michael McCusker. So, if you get sick, get on your bicycle and ride to the clinic. Well, this past Monday, was International Left-Handers Day. And this next Monday is International Humanitarian Day, which will also be my birthday, the 19th. I would like to at least read about the lefties, because I am left-handed. And that's how I will start this little article I've read before, Children of Satan, I Am Left-Handed, which is easier to be than in the past. Catholic nuns vigorously attempted to make me right-handed when I started school and accused me of being a son of Satan, which I refused. I don't know why most people are right-handed. Because they are, the right hand is the hand of sustenance and labor, and the vile left hand began its evil reputation in ancient times when it was used to clean away the body's excrement. Thus, from antiquity, has developed a sophisticated aversion to the left side of things. Prejudice against people who are left-handed predates more familiar bigotries of race, religion, nationality, gender, and homophobia. In every culture before record, all that is good and righteous has been accorded the right hand, while everything evil, ugly, wrong-headed, or simply bad luck is the left. In politics, as well as society, a crude bicameral cleft is made between right and left. The established order that resists change is the political and cultural right, capital R, which usually defends itself with tradition, religion, and autocratic power. The political left, lowercase l, is the force of change and reform that calls upon the future instead of the past and explores new ideas and innovative social and political approaches to greater freedom and well-being of the common citizenry. Left is about justice, not privilege. The left is the opposition. Once in power, it automatically reverts to the right. For all the problems Western democracies have had with communism and socialism, words that mean community and society, when stripped of ideological abstraction, the ideas at their roots grew as alternatives to rapid industrialization in the 19th century, demanding in philosophy, if not practice, more than servitude for the mushrooming working classes as their share for producing the technological revolution throughout Western Europe and North America. Fascism and Nazism is an extreme right-wing reaction to these leftist heresies of class, i.e. social and political parity, that communist and socialist societies generally become totalitarian states of the political right should not repudiate the underlying perception shared with the democracies, themselves flawed and corrupt, that there is enough for everyone and everyone is equal under law. Reform, resistance, and rebellion to contemporary rule in the United States has since at least the Russian Revolution been called by assaulted authority leftist, a sinister, from Latin, sinus, meaning left or unlucky, hint at Bolshevik conspiracy, a suspicion of alien agents or homegrown dupes of foreign strategies to destroy the American way of life operating within its very heart. In other words, dissent and resistance to authority and or injustice in this land of liberty and justice is implied to be treachery. Perhaps because of ancient and immediate hostility toward left-handed people, we are usually supporters of underdogs and outcasts and feel personally sympathetic to ideals of personal and political liberty. Left-handed people share with women and minority races and religions, not to mention people with physical and mental handicaps, the problems of survival in a world designed with no consideration for their presence in it, or, much worse, designed to eradicate their presence. And that was my paean toward being left-handed. Children of Satan. And I should probably state about this point that, and the articles I'm about to read, or at least the next article, that this is my opinion and perhaps my opinion in the entire cosmos. Of course, we might have left-handed planets somewhere, or even galaxies. Now, I'd like to read something that I read now and then around this time of summer, even though it looks like it's winter out there, or beginning of it. I call it Summers of Love and War, and the disclaimer I just made applies because I wrote it, and I'll start with a quote from Abbie Hoffman. You cannot have change without the young. The young have the creativity, they have the energy, they have the impatience. You need the youth to dissent. All sorts of people in prime middle age are reminiscing about the summer of 1967, which they call the Summer of Love, a drug-induced hallucination in which several thousand, mostly, pampered middle and upper-class white, flower, children briefly abandoned social strictures and sang, danced, and fornicated like most of us imagine our wild and unfettered ancestors to have done in the primeval belt before civilization and Christianity dampened our freewheeling pagan spirits. Mecca, that legendary summer, years ago, would have been 49 years ago, was San Francisco, Baghdad by the day. Historic incubator and refuge, I beg your pardon, 46 years ago, was San Francisco, Baghdad by the bay. Historic incubator and refuge for many radical and eccentric mythologies. For an ephemeral moment in a nation torn apart by an unpopular war and racial strife, a quicksilver of fun and peace rippled through the stoned young masses who had swarmed into the city from all over the country with heads swaddled in blossoms. A song that summer urged westward-bound emigres, if you go to San Francisco, wear a flower in your hair. An ad hoc socialist republic boomed and bust as rapidly as an old gold rush town. Everything seemed free for the asking. Food, lodging, medical care, sex, and wine. Even the psychedelic drugs that fueled the dreamlike vision of a world of harmony, peace, and love. It all went badly, quickly, of course. Before the summer was over, evil spirits had merged with the blithe, frolicking throngs of nirvana seekers, stealing, assaulting, and raping, selling toxic drugs, and generally creating an infection of bad vibrations. The rhapsodies of nostalgia about that long ago and faraway summer seemed to ease over the ruthless struggles of that period. That same summer of 1967, American cities burned with racial hatred and insurrection, also despair. More than 200 other young Americans were dying in Vietnam every week, and God, Buddha alone, knows how many thousands of Vietnamese were killed between each Sunday and Saturday. The dream world itself soon darkened into nightmare. Two summers later, the counterculture that grew from the Summer of Love produced its most famous citizen, Charles Manson. The 1960s are set apart from other decades. They are different not so much for their intensity, the World War II years were far more intense in the 40s, or because they were flamboyant and colorful, the jazz age of the 1920s had more splash, or for that matter because they were fueled by division and insurrection. The 1770s and 1860s make better claims, and of course the 1930s were the first Great Depression. The significance of the 1960s is the example provided by the nation's indulgence in its youth, or perhaps more aptly, with a single, immensely large generation of young people who responded by paradoxically souring on the nation at a time of unparalleled prosperity. The 1960s were a tumultuous period. The civil rights movement of primarily Southern blacks gave rise to a white civil rights movement of primarily disaffected youth who protested an unpopular and ill-conceived war that forced young males to fight and possibly be crippled or die. For the most part, the children of the working classes went quietly into induction and the war, and most of the nearly 60,000 dead and several hundred thousand wounded came from their homes. Primary opposition to the Vietnam War came from the nation's middle-class youth. As usual, upper-class whites were protected and could avoid service in the war, although many went into service, typically as officers, or were engaged in anti-war protest. Rampant ideologies and social solutions were conceived and died in the turbulent years of that decade. Revolution was a serious and futile flirtation, a malevolent and adolescent reaction against a paternal system that refused reform or criticism. Young Americans turned to animistic socialism, a new left replaced the old left and developed a political philosophy that loosely resembled gypsy law. They thought they could bind state socialism and social control with a tribal sense of individual freedom. The police and military showed the young resistors to authority that social change takes hard work and great pain, which few were inclined to exert. Reality, which means that all dreams take time for fruition and are modified by reality, disillusioned the young once more. The now generation found some other nows to be now about. A frustrated few tried to push against history, but were mostly killed or hunted into jail. Accidental explosion of homemade bombs literally wasted some of the best and brightest. If the 1967 summer of love and flower power was a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale for the young baby boomers, 1968 was surely a tale by the Brothers Grimm. It was a torrid year of assassinations, vainglorious battles in the overseas war, and increasingly violent anti-war demonstrations, generally set off by police and National Guards armed with clubs, guns, and gas. The presidential campaign failed to change anything. The new Republican administration that was elected despised the young protesters and attacked them more viciously than ever, 2 years later culminating in the shooting deaths of 4 white students at Kent State in Ohio and at least 2 blacks, both women, at Jackson State University in Mississippi. The government also staged a number of show trials of anti-war activists in the late 1960s and early 1970s, but juries acquitted them all. In 1969, anti-war radicals responded to police murders of Black Panthers and arrests of activists by forming a violent vanguard that proclaimed the beginning of revolution, the Weathermen, later Weather People, whose rhetoric was always considerably more revolutionary than their acts, and whose homemade bombs blew up in their faces. But 1968, which was 45 years ago, was also a year when an international youth movement might have linked. Not since 1848 had Europe been so united behind barricades. France, West Germany, Czechoslovakia, remember the Prague Spring, and in Mexico at the 1968 Olympic Games, and Chicago, USA, on our side of the world. Revolutionary politics are saturated with hoped-for might-have-beens. No connection was made other than sympathetic, though often inflamed, oratory. In 1968, the war in Vietnam reached its most dramatic and painful peak, the Winter Tet Offensive by North Vietnamese armies and Viet Cong guerrillas, which included the long and bloody siege at Khe San, reminiscent of Dien Bien Phu 14 years earlier. 1968 was the moral low water mark of the war, the devastation of the ancient imperial city of Hue and the slaughter of civilians by American soldiers at My Lai. President Lyndon Johnson surrendered his presidency to the war in 1968, and Dr. Martin Luther King sacrificed his life organizing poor blacks and whites against the economic system that impoverished them. Robert Kennedy, brother of the assassinated President John Kennedy, campaigned for the presidency on a promise to end the war and provide justice to the poor, and was murdered moments after victory in the California primary in June. In August 1968, a peak was also reached in the anti-war movement at the violent spectacle of the Democratic Party's National Convention in Chicago. The whole world was watching. Although culturalists claim the 1960s got into swing around 1968, the theme of the decade was set at its start with the Black Civil Rights Movement. Not only did the violent and passionate search for racial justice inspire the later anti-war revolutionary New Left, earliest leaders of the movement were tempered by their own personal involvement in civil rights in the American South, registering blacks to vote, marching with blacks, and sharing the violent reaction. The other major influence was the Vietnam War, which provided the ignition point of youthful, mostly white rebellion, and added hardened veterans of the war to the largely college-oriented movement opposing it. The veterans, like the civil rights activists, were experienced with violence and capably reacted to attacks by police and state militias attempting to quell the revolt against national policy. The war that seasoned and repelled them became immersed in leftist ideology, although many vets did not approve of it. Yet the political right had failed them, had inducted them into an unholy war cloaked in righteous deceit, made them prisoners of conscience. Whereas the early New Left had been inspired by the civil rights movement and embraced liberation philosophies, the veterans came into the anti-war movement angry and embittered. Most of the veterans had a limited focus that ultimately was fatal to their campaign, far short of its goal to end the war. Similar to the majority of New Left organizations, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, VVAW, was at first stimulated by argument, but eventually debate and disagreement degenerated into quarreling animosities that broke the group apart. All that survived were two mutually hostile splinter groups that orbited afar an exotic fringe. The U.S. government's most powerful counterstroke was to virtually end the military draft, which almost immediately defused the rebellion. Draft-age males assured of avoiding combat service lost interest in the immorality of the war and also stopped thinking and talking about ideas and issues that grew from the war. Only diehards and incurable idealists persisted against the new wave of apathy driven by hopeful or grim visions. The New Left dissipated into a pablum of New Age kitsch. There were always contradictions among the countercultures of the 1960s. Hip culture chasing a buck in contrast to politicized hippies who wanted to abolish wealth. Nirvana seeking acid heads versus hardcore speed freaks and junkies. But everybody was against and in fear of the cops. The flower power dream of transcending materialism with goodwill failed, but not before it seeded the environmental movement and made ideas about pacifism, justice, and equality respectable. The most far-reaching legacy of the inspired and self-indulgent 1960s is the women's movement. The lingering problem, however, is that the fun-seeking nation adopted the sex, drug, and party habits of the young boomers, but not the philosophies or politics. Young Ben Braddock, as portrayed by Dustin Hoffman in the film version of The Graduate, written by Charles Webb, spoke for a disillusioned generation of baby boomers in early maturity when he said, "I don't know what I am, Dad, and I don't particularly care." Later, that spiritual emptiness would gorge on frenzied materialism, but for a short period, a large number of primarily affluent young Americans attempted to combat cultural nihilism with experiments toward a moral republic, which was to be lightly governed for the benefit of all persons by intelligent goodwill. Some among the restless tribe that worshipped the image of eternal youth never got much older, swept up in the war that everyone seemed powerless to stop. A few endured jail to avoid the war or sought exile in other countries. Others resisted the war and defiantly braved guns, clubs, and disabling chemicals of police and National Guardsmen, many of whom enlisted in state militias to avoid service in the war. The drugs that opened the minds of thousands of alienated children seared them to ash in subsequent years. Although the baby boom generation temporarily repudiated the corrupt leadership and incessant greed of the nation, rapidly germinating and degenerating, dizzily heady ideologies and social solutions, it grew increasingly fond of the riches it had previously loathed. Most softened their resistance to the 7-Eleven values of their culture as they grew older. Communal patterns and politics were abandoned. Business networking among the former rebels replaced communalism. The happily acquisitive, workaholic, well-dined yuppie metamorphed from the angst-ridden flower-child hippie who thought universal love and open sex would make the world a better place. Yuppies contortedly justified their pursuit of wealth and status as fully compatible with their lingering sympathies for social justice. Now the baby boomers who made so much trouble to their families and their country while they were growing up are as old or older than their parents a generation and more ago. The war that traumatized their vulnerable youth is long over, although its residue continues to disturb amnesia and newer wars are on the horizon. The psychopathic Cold War they grew up with ended abruptly with the collapse and disintegration of the Russian Communist Empire. The summer of love was the generation's iridescent mirage, the watershed of its vanished youth. They were born after World War II, and their memories don't include the daily sounds of bombers and bombs that tormented and killed children all over the world a few years earlier. Yet their continuing angst is a legacy of their parents' war. They were born under the sign of the mushroom cloud. More than their rebellion against prosperity and its flaccid corruption of spirit, their dread of nuclear holocaust defined their passionate protest against the Vietnam War, more even than personal fears of young males they would be drafted into it. This first nuclear generation, also the first television generation, felt a shared stake in the future, and apart from hype and herd instinct, they tried to be kind to one another. They are so large a generation, they crash through history as irresistibly as fire, remaking everything they sweep past. They are so accustomed to the attention of society, particularly its merchants, they believe they are the force of history itself. And that was something I wrote, Summers of Love and War. And sort of to continue the theme, I'd like to read some excerpts from a couple of other articles that appeared in my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, as did that one I had just read. This one by Astoria's own Barbara Darby, and it was initially published in the July-August 1999 Times-Eagle. Too many wounds. The time my friends and I sought out and joined the counterculture movement was a time of many paradoxes for us. These contradictions involved our generation's hopes for the future and the abundance of deaths and injuries happening to that same generation. The wounds that happened to our leaders and our friends shattered our view of a loving world. One by one, as each new ideal was taken away, our lives became more meaningless. We fled from this loss of meaning in our lives, and instead of pursuing success and obtaining the American dream, as our parents had before us, we became part of a new and exciting counterculture movement. We became a large voice in the 60s and early 70s, and many of us used this voice in opposition to much of the oppression and injustice that was part of our American society during these and other times. Some say there was no reason for the counterculture movement. They say it just happened or was an extension of the beat generation of the 50s. The counterculture movement may have originated earlier, however. The mass exodus of this alternative way of living in the late 60s and early 70s did not just happen. It was caused by the abundance of wounds in our society that overshadowed our lives during those times. Our friends were beginning to return from Vietnam, wounded and unable to relate to us the atrocities they were forced to be involved in. We comforted their return to our society as much as we could. We also knew they were somehow altered forever by the experience. Some friends died, gentle people blown to pieces. We felt powerless to change the direction of what was happening to our lives and country. This is when I believe the greatest exodus into the counterculture took place. We were defeated, and it was time to find our own way. Our country and our generation had suffered too many wounds. It was a time for our own type of civil disobedience. My friends and I read Tom Wolfe's The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which was published in 1968. It was about the lives of Ken Kesey and his friends on a cross-country trip in a psychedelic bus, and we turned our eager minds and thoughts to that adventure in the same manner we had devoured the books of John Steinbeck. This led to our acceptance of the drug culture, and we explored and experienced all it had to offer. We hitchhiked to San Francisco and visited the places where it began. We went to see the Grateful Dead and attended music festivals, where we freely ingested the drugs we brought to share or were offered by others. The best marijuana was sent or carried home by our friends in Vietnam. We had good times and became accustomed to living with limited resources. We were fond of talking about President Washington's hemp garden or Aldous Huxley's LSD trips. Musicians, poets and writers, leaders and creators living in the 60s and at other times before and since are known to have used drugs to expand their view of their work and of the world. It is well known that mind-expanding drugs brought about changes in the music and lifestyles of many musicians and poets during the time of the counterculture movement. Indeed, drugs were a force that changed the consciousness of many who were eager to try new and different ways of looking at life. However, those who label drugs as the main reason and attention of the counterculture miss the truth of those times by a large margin. The use of drugs did influence the movement and changed and sometimes led to the enlightenment of many who took them as well as those who didn't. Drugs also led to deepening existing wounds in society. Friends died from overdose and others contracted lifelong disabilities because of their use. Straights just had to and did put a stop to the unrestricted use of them. They felt drugs eroded users' ideas of what and how a capitalist society should be and behave. Their actions caused much of the paranoia that became attributed to their smoking of marijuana and the taking of other drugs. Their attitudes contributed to more violent actions against American citizens, which caused additional wounds. There were many in the counterculture movement who never took drugs or never inhaled. The counterculture was a way to divorce ourselves from the wounds that were being inflicted on citizens by other citizens. By the time the Vietnam War was finally over, we barely noticed. We weren't watching the nightly news anymore. We began only to care about what was happening in our immediate circle of friends and about the highs we could obtain and the fun we could experience. When the war finally ended, we were most likely with our friends who had returned from it, drinking dime beers at the local tavern. We could be found pausing from our conversations to join in as the whole crowded room sang in unison the ballad in which Don McLean told with a poet's voice the story of our times, American Pie. So what about us now? We are still around, and many of us still live with the wounds that have lasted from that time. We still distrust our government and its policies. We fail to fight for many just causes because we feel they will never be won through political means. Most of us still live within and take part in our polluting and consumer-oriented society, and we also live with the guilt of its wastefulness and environmental destruction. Those of us who took LSD still wonder at the enlightenment about life and death that it gave us. We still get very angry when any injustice occurs. Some of us still support many of the causes we have always believed in, and our new American dream is that peace will still come. Many of us still pause in reflection when trying to decipher right from wrong, and still have trouble finding the middle ground. We will always carry the wounds that caused the counterculture with us. They reside along with the strength gained from the healing of those wounds, and I am hopeful that this is what will be passed on to future generations. And that was Too Many Wounds by Barbara Darby. And she wrote this little piece, and that's just an excerpt from it, from for the North Coast Times-Eagle in... Flip the page back over again. July, August, 1999. And a couple of quotes. From I.F. Stone, 1968. This idealistic youth is the same youth already serving in the Peace Corps abroad and the poverty program at home. They are the seed corn of a better future. They embody the strain of idealism, which in every generation has written the best chapters in our American history. They are the spiritual heirs of the Jeffersonians and abolitionists. Julius Lester, also in 1968. The student radical has never heard talking about a rise in the price of milk, new taxes, real wages, or doctor bills. The student radical creates his own society in which money is not an overriding problem, and because it isn't, the student radical thinks revolution is all about love, because he has the time to think about love. Everybody else is talking about survival. And my deceased and one of my best friends, Michael Marsh, said in 1971, "You are a bunch of incompetent dreamers. You promised a revolution, and where the hell is it? Because you are too lazy or incapable of being real revolutionaries, I am being forced to pay off my student loan." And Michael died 20 years later in 1991. And now I'd like to flip a couple of pages here. And read a poem. It's my friend and a woman I will always love, Julie's birthday yesterday, which was VJ Day, and she was born on VJ 1945. Julie and VJ Day. You might have been named Victoria Jane. You knew a girl who was. Poor girl, you said. You are 68, VJ Day, the day you were born. The World War ended. Millions dead. Gone. Never more forever. You are new life, born amidst burial. A sad world you make warm. You unconditional mother. You wonderful woman. I love you always. And I wrote that. And this has been Michael McCusker.